So as I said earlier, we're now in a series called Pursuing Balance. Now there's lots of ways, we know there's lots of ways to pursue balance in our lives. There's work-life balance, a very worthy pursuit. We can seek balance in our relationship to creation, learning how to reduce our impact on an overstressed world. There's also an important, we also can work on our relationships, relationship balance, making time for family and spouse and friends. And we can also work on balancing our finances, learning how to not overspend and how to save, and also an essential skill that's necessary, a priority in life. There are many, many worthy quests for balance in life. But the kind of balance we're talking about in this series is creating balance in the way we purposefully interact with the world, with our time and our energy. And one of the things all these balance pursuits have in common is they take intentionality. We don't fall into balance by accident. It always takes a decision and a follow-through commitment. We aspire towards a goal, and then we put energy behind the task. So look at the image we've been staring at the screen for the last 3 weeks. How many of you have ever been able to balance a spinning basketball on your finger? Anybody? Nobody. Wow, we're just not cool enough. But it is a doable task, so I'm told. I've seen people do it. But you have to apply yourself to learning how to do this kind of thing. It takes practice. And then when that ball does get balanced on your finger, you can't forget about it and then expect that it's going to just stay spinning there while you do other things. You have to pay attention to the forces that are working against it and continually make subtle adjustments to keep it from spinning off your finger. And if you put your attention elsewhere, the ball just falls. Because balance is hard to achieve, and it's hard to keep. We have to dedicate our mind and our heart and our energy to it if we're going to have any hope of achieving balance of any kind and holding on to it. The balance we're talking about this fall is the aspiration to build solitude, community, and ministry into our lives. We're focusing on this three-pronged pattern because this is a pattern that we find in Jesus' life. It worked for him to follow this pattern. One of the things we learn in the scriptures is Jesus came to earth to show us how to live into the life that we were created for. So choosing to be a Christian is choosing to model our lives around the lives of Jesus, after the life of Jesus. So taking on Jesus' pattern of life is one of the big ways that we become like Jesus. And it may seem weird that we're prioritizing this pattern so much and talking like it's an essential part of the Christian life. But the reason we're teaching this is because when this pattern gets set as our foundation, and once it's working, all the other elements of our Christian faith flow out of this pattern. If you want a dynamic, powerful faith life, build it on this foundation that we're talking about now. This is our third and final week talking about solitude. And I've become a great fan of solitude myself, though I didn't used to be. I never practiced it because I was afraid to be alone with myself. So I was proactive about everything that I could do, doing everything I could to hide from myself. And part of my proactivity was never giving space for solitude, never even giving it a fair try. You know, you can hide from yourself in lots of different ways. I had learned really well how to hide myself from me. And it wasn't hard. In fact, it was easy. Because as you know, there's a whole world of distractions to grab hold of and to choose from. Our culture teaches us to fill all the silences with distractions, so we don't have to face our own reality. We learn to hide from our thoughts and feelings instead of facing them. But solitude is a practice that stands up and says no to hiding, no to distracting, no to ignoring what's going on inside of us, and no to pretending everything's okay. Solitude is the Spirit of God calling us into stillness so we can come face to face with whatever is inside of us. In solitude, we stand with the Spirit and learn how to see ourselves and the world around us through Jesus' eyes. And when you finally let yourself get there, it's probably quite different than what you expected it would be like. Last week, we had an amazing sermon by Julia Bowering. If you missed it, I highly recommend that you go on the website and listen to it. She worked through Mark 1, 9 through 13, which is Jesus' baptism, his anointing by the Spirit of God, and his temptation in the desert. And one of the things that she highlighted was what happened when Jesus was obedient to the Spirit. When he went down to the river that day to be baptized, and then went out with the Spirit for an extended period of solitude. First and foremost, Jesus was given extraordinary affirmation and love. Through his anointing and his time in the wilderness, Jesus became profoundly aware of his belovedness. These 40 days weren't a time of torture. They were a time of deep communion between Jesus and the Father. The full confidence, he received this full confidence that the Father loved him. Full confidence that the Father was completely for him. And this together became the source of his confidence and strength as he faced the temptations that would follow this time of solitude. And this continued to be the foundation of the power that undergirded his ministry. Jesus entered into solitude with the Father, and the experience prepared him for the life that was ahead of him. And Jesus emerged from this experience a different man. Communion with the Father in solitude made everything that he did later on possible. And just so we're clear, this isn't just a one-time thing, but it was a regular practice for Jesus. We're told that on several occasions, Jesus went off to be alone with the Father. And it's not like Jesus didn't have other stuff to do. We all know he did. But he chose to take precious time away from ministry to be with the Father so that his ministry could then flow out of this communion. This is one of the core things we want to get across with this part of the series. So often we have the best of intentions and we serve God to serve God faithfully by serving others. We step out, we want to do it. And we see important things that just need to be done, so we just jump out and do them. But because we don't start with solitude, we end up going it alone on our own strength. And on our own strength so often just gives out on us. On our own strength, our passion fizzles. We can get grumpy or feel taken for granted, and we can even burn out. I see it happening to people. I've burned out myself a couple times. We limp along, running on fumes, and instead we could be thriving. And by thriving, I mean that when we're thriving, we love to serve. We actually want to serve God in the church. That is what's possible. We serve, but we're not doing it out of habit or duty or guilt. When we follow the example of Jesus, we practice solitude first. And then those encounters with God fuel the rest of our lives, and they empower everything else that we do. Everything. Those who practice solitude first with Jesus do life with Jesus instead of for Jesus. Big difference there. Doing life with Jesus instead of for Jesus. And many Christians miss out on this completely. Some of you have missed out on this completely because for whatever reason, you haven't made solitude a regular practice in your daily life. Now, I'm not saying it's easy to do this. It's not. It's really, really hard, actually. And I can honestly tell you, I have had a lifelong struggle to make this happen. But I encourage you to join me in the struggle to make solitude a foundational priority in your life. So I was really struggling with solitude for the first 2 years of my work here. And it wasn't that I wasn't spending time with God, but I was having a really hard time connecting with God during those times. And this wasn't a common problem for me before I started working in the church. But something about doing this job was changing the way my brain was working and experiencing life. My best guess was that I was emotionally drained from the job, and it made it very hard for me to connect with God. So when I came to God, I just had nothing to draw from. And there was always, on top of that, there was always a very long, niggling to-do list that was sort of clamoring in the back of my brain whenever I met with God. So I knew I needed to find a way to renew my connection to the Spirit that would fit with the reality that I found myself in. So I decided that I would prioritize solitude, which meant not stopping trying to find a way to connect with the Spirit. I wasn't going to stop until I figured out how to do it. And the first thing I tried was to go on an 8-day silent retreat. And it turned out that that was the answer to all my prayers and my hopes. I met with God in a way that I had never experienced before. And just like Julia talked about last week, as we would expect, God's first order of business was convincing me that I was God's beloved. And even though God had so much more to say to me than that, the thread that bound the whole thing together was that I was loved and valued. The Spirit made it very clear to me that God's desire for me was to live out of that place every day. It was a deeply transforming experience, and it was exactly what I needed. It was a perfect fit for my situation in that moment, a perfect fix for the problem I had, you might say. In fact, it was so perfect and so relevant, I signed up to return and go do the same thing again this year. Now, you might think that this was a happy coincidence, that the very first thing that I tried turned out to be the right thing. But I don't think it's a coincidence. Actually, I'm sure it was no coincidence. And there's a reason, this is the whole reason that I'm telling you all of this. Because the church knows how to get you to the place where you can have a meaningful encounter with the Spirit. In the church, we have a legacy of 2,000 years of stories and experiences of people pursuing God. 2,000 years of people finding God. 2,000 years of attempts and fails. 2,000 years of eventual successes from a wide array of different kinds of lives and different kinds of stories. And it's given us 2,000 years of compiled knowledge and experiences and wisdom. And that wisdom hasn't been lost. Wherever you are right now, someone else has already been there and has succeeded in their quest to find communion with the Spirit of God. And their journey has been recorded. Your way forward has already been forged by a Christian ancestor just waiting for you to find it. It's that wisdom that I tapped into when I was beating my head against a wall because I couldn't hear God the way I used to, when my old practices were no longer working in my new situation. I talked all of this over with my friend Elizabeth, who's a gifted spiritual director, and I told her what I was experiencing. And knowing what I know about the church, what the church teaches about encounters with God, I figured that a silent retreat was probably the right thing to do with a spiritual director. And I figured that was where I should go next. And I was being hopeful, though, that maybe I could get done what I thought needed doing in 3 days. But after hearing my story, I heard Elizabeth inform me that I actually needed to go for 8 days. And she was the expert, so I did what she said. And she was exactly right. So in case you don't know, spiritual directors are trained to help you connect with God. That is their job. And a big part of their training is to learn that 2,000-year-long story of the human quest for personal connection with God. They learn the ways that people have been successful and then help use that knowledge to teach us and guide us on our own quests. They're incredibly good at what they do, and they have a great deal of success. And if you're seeking God, I highly recommend that you seek out a spiritual director as your guide as well, at least if you are able to do this. But there's other kinds of guides that can help you access God and navigate your quest. If you're a reader, there is so much available to you, a whole world that you can access from the comfort of your own couch. I can recommend to you lots of resources, as can Tammy Pierce and Cheryl Breakwell, who are both trained here as spiritual directors. Some of our life groups are working through material specifically designed to help us make personal connections with God. If you want to know which ones, if you're interested, come talk to me and I'll help you get connected. So the point I'm trying to make with all of this is that communion with the Spirit is an achievable quest. No matter where you are in your life, no matter your situation, no matter your story, no matter what kind of brain or mind you have, no matter how it functions, it's an achievable quest. Someone like you has done it before you. You know, so we put so much of our energy into our life quests. We really do. If you or your child plays a sport well, or dances, or has a hobby, think about how much time or energy and money and effort and sacrifice you have put into making that possible. I learned how to play the flute. I started in high school and I did it right at the university. I'm sure I hit my 10,000 hours. It was an insane amount of work and time and effort and discipline to be able to do that. And it took a lot of creative effort to try and figure out how to navigate the problems that came up. I bet many of you have done this. I bet some of you have had to also be very creative in the ways you figured out how to overcome some of the challenges of accomplishing those goals. So if we really believe that communion with God is the foundation of the Christian life, don't you think it's worth the struggle to make this happen? We're a creative people with a lot of resources that are available to us as a community. Maybe you're a single parent. You might think you can't take a day or a weekend to be alone with God. Well, would it be possible to get together with another single parent and take care of each other's children? So often I hear a lot of people say that things can't be done when very little creative energy has been spent trying to come up with ways to make it happen. Very little conversation has been had with others to figure out how to find a workable option. Sometimes all that's needed is to prioritize time with the Spirit and to put it in your calendar. So this silent retreat that I'm going to be going to again in February is a priority to me. It's in my calendar now. I booked it way ahead. And I treat it the same way I would treat a special vacation. I will work the rest of my life around it. I'll find a way to pay for it because I know it's really important. I encourage you to leave here today thinking about your own quest to meet with God in solitude. Add it to your to-do list to pursue communion until it happens, until you make a heart-to-heart connection with Jesus. This is the foundation of our faith. We are meant to live out of it. Everything flows out of it. Everything. So instead of starting with a new story this week, I'm returning to the story that Julia spoke on last week, but focusing on the back half of the story that she really just touched on, the temptations that came at the end of Jesus' time of solitude in the wilderness. So I'm going to read instead. She spoke from Mark, and I'm going to speak instead from the same story that occurs in Matthew. So I'm going to read from Matthew 3:13. Then Jesus came from Galilee to the Jordan to be baptized by John. But John tried to deter him, saying, "I need to be baptized by you, and do you come to me?" Jesus replied, "Let it be so now. It is proper for us to do this to fulfill all righteousness." Then John consented. As soon as Jesus was baptized, he went up out of the water. At that moment, heaven was opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." Jesus answered, it is written, "Man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." Then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. "If you are the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down, for it is written, 'He will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands, so that you will not strike your foot against a stone.'" Jesus answered him, "It is also written, 'Do not put the Lord your God to the test.'" Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. "All this I will give you," he said, "if you bow down and worship me." Jesus said to him, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, 'Worship the Lord your God and serve him only.'" Then the devil left him, and angels came and attended him. So these temptations came after Jesus spent 40 days in deep communion with the Spirit. After 40 days spent in the loving presence of the Father, being loved, affirmed, and centered. Now, we don't know how much Jesus knew about God the Father's plan for him before his baptism. That's a mystery. What we do know, that by the time Jesus has reached the end of his 40 days, his mission has become crystal clear to him. Jesus knows he's the Messiah. His purpose has been laid out before him. But will he yield completely to the will of the Father, or will he go the way of his ancestors? Will he be like the first son of man, Adam, God's first attempt at the human experiment, who failed in the very easiest of circumstances? Will he be like Israel, God's second human experiment, now a group experiment, who together failed at every turn to yield to the will of the Father, and they failed over and over again for centuries? Everything was riding on Jesus. This was God's third attempt to create heaven on earth, a kingdom that could save everything. And everything hinged on this one man. This man needed to be tested to see if he would be able to bear the burden of everything that was going to be placed on him. So the Spirit allowed the devil to throw his worst at him with three very focused challenges. Temptation one. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. A tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." Jesus was hungry. I think that's safe to say it's an understatement. After 40 days without food, Jesus was dying of starvation. This is the first temptation, and it is about trust. Jesus is being tempted to take his own well-being out of God's hands and put it into his own. He's being tempted to take control of his own life. If Jesus refuses to save his own life here, which is in real jeopardy at this point, then he is entrusting himself to the care of the Father. By saying no to the devil here, he is saying that he is willing to trust the Father with his very life, even to the point of death, which seems at this moment to be a very likely possibility. And Jesus passes the test. Temptation two. Then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of this temple. "If you are the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down, for it is written, 'He will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands, so that you will not strike your feet against a stone. Like with this first temptation, Jesus had the ability to act on the temptation. As the Son of God, he had the ability to take control of the story. And this could have been his great moment of glory. Instead of submitting to the call that had been placed upon him for a quiet, slow ministry in Galilee, full of struggle, as he toiled away in some obscurity, he could have ended it before he began. Instead of being continually antagonized by Sadducees and Pharisees, he could have been worshipped by all of them. He could have announced his reign to the world right then and there, flying in with an army of angels right off the top of the temple. Wouldn't that have been spectacular? Ushering in the glorious age of the Messiah. He could have done this and bypassed the cross altogether. But Jesus said no. This temptation was about perfect submission to the will and ways of the Father. And Jesus passed this test. Temptation number 3. The devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. "All this I will give you," he said, "if you bow down and worship me." Perhaps this is the hardest temptation of them all. I say this because ruling over all the kingdoms of the world is the whole reason that Jesus laid down his glory in the first place. The Father sent the Son to earth to ultimately get to the place where all the kingdoms on earth would be submitted under the rule of the Son. The devil was offering Jesus the mother of all shortcuts to the end of the story. How many Jewish wars could be averted if he worshiped the devil just this one time? Imagine all the lives that could be saved. Jesus could usher in the kingdom of peace today. Talk about the perfect example of being tempted to do something wrong for all the right reasons. But Jesus resisted. Jesus would trust. Jesus would worship God and God alone. And Jesus would not compromise his ministry path for a shortcut. Jesus passed the test. We're meant to understand that these are real temptations for Jesus. This was not just an exercise. This was Jesus walking through fire to die to his will. And he arrived on the other side of the experience, transcendent. Very, very different. Very other. God and human perfectly bound together for the entire world to see. So there's a link here that many of us miss. Jesus' blessing from God in his time of solitude came immediately before his temptations. In fact, they prepared him for his success. When we think of all the temptations that we face and all the times that we fail to live according to the kingdom values that we've committed ourselves to, how different would our stories be if we had followed Jesus' example and sprinkled our lives with regular times of solitude with Jesus? How different. Communion with God has the power to form us into people who are able to succeed the way that Jesus succeeded. To be people who can trust in God when life isn't going our way. Into people who are able to submit to God and God's ways and resist taking moral shortcuts when opportunities come forward to us. To be people who resist all the things that are begging for our time and attention so we have space to worship the one true God. Communion with the Spirit through solitude results in success in temptation. The Spirit set Jesus up for success, and the Spirit wants to do the same thing for us as well. The Spirit is calling you into solitude the same way that the Spirit was calling Jesus. Now, there's a difference between what happened in Jesus' time of solitude and what happens in ours. Of course there is. The love is the same, of course, and the affirmation is the same. You will receive this. But unlike Jesus, solitude will give us opportunities to gradually, step by step, face our own truth. And this is what I had been afraid of all those years before, when I'd been avoiding being with myself. I'd been right to avoid being alone with myself. I was a cruel self-critic, but in solitude, we're not alone with ourselves. And the Spirit of God is not an accuser. The Spirit of God is kind and patient and loving. And the Spirit of God helps us see what we need to see in pieces. The Spirit can take us back into our most shameful moments and show us how much God loved us when we were at our very worst. And those kind of revelations can free us from our past so we can make a new kind of future with Jesus. Futures where we can cling to the Spirit for dear life, because we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Spirit of God is on our side. The Spirit of God is for you. Solitude is not what you think it's going to be. It's love and compassion and the very best kind of help that you can imagine to help you move forward in freedom from the past and into tomorrow. No matter what you've done, no matter what you're doing, love piled up on top of love, and the Spirit and you together carving out a new hope and a new future in a brand new, different way. Will you take this idea home with you today? Will you find a way to make space for solitude?